Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, June 8, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, Abusive Civil and Criminal Enforcement, The Farmer and the CEO. My name is Tim Courtney. I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome our experts, Robert Everett Johnson, an attorney at the Institute for Justice, and Paul Kaminar, Washington, D.C. attorney and senior fellow at the Administrative Conference of the United States. Thanks for speaking with us today, you two. I think today we're going to lead off with Paul Kaminar. So with that, Paul, the floor is yours.
Hey, thanks, Tim, and I want to thank the Federalist Society for hosting this teleforum and its other efforts to put the spotlight on the problems of overcriminalization and abusive federal prosecutions. About 2 weeks ago, the House Subcommittee of Oversight of the Ways and Means Committee held its second hearing in as many years on the IRS and the Department of Justice practice of seizing bank accounts of small businesses for allegedly engaging in, quote, structuring, end quote, of cash deposits or withdrawals under $10,000, even when there has been no underlying criminal transaction or activity, such as drug sales, terrorism, or tax evasion. Now, my client, Randy Sowers, who's a Maryland farmer, here was invited to testify at both those hearings, basically describe how his dream of running his successful dairy farm turned into a nightmare one day when armed federal agents showed up at his farm. Just a little background, his farm, his wife started this over 30 years ago, and with hard work and 18-hour days, 7 days a week, they have a dairy farm, produce milk, eggs, cheese, ice cream, and other dairy products. They've won awards and certifications for humane and environmentally sensitive farming practices. Now, besides home deliveries, they have successful farmers market sales in Maryland cities, including Baltimore, on weekends where they are well-known and well-liked. Well, after one successful weekend of sales, Karen Sowers went to the bank the following Monday with more than $10,000 in cash, and the teller asked her if she wouldn't mind depositing less than $10,000 because the teller would have to fill out some paperwork, and Karen was more than glad to accommodate the teller. She would keep some cash back at the farm to pay some bills. That was fine by her, and this practice went on for several months. Some weeks their cash deposits proceeds were over $10,000, some were under $10,000, but Karen kept that under $10,000 to accommodate the banker's request. Then one day, two armed federal IRS agents showed up, and they asked about the cash deposits. The Sowers cooperated with them. They showed them their bank deposit records and explained that the proceeds were from farmer market sales and so forth. But that didn't matter. They were told that their bank account of some $60,000 was seized the day before, and they slapped him with a criminal grand jury subpoena, which was issued 3 or 4 days before that. Well, you can imagine what happened. Their checks started to bounce. Creditors were calling. Their world was turned upside down. What was their crime? As I said, the Bank Secrecy Act requires that if you deposit more than $10,000, the banks to fill out what's called a currency transaction report. If you keep it under $10,000 and there's a pattern of that, they fill out what's called a suspicious activity report and send that into IRS. Their local attorney contacted me. We contacted the prosecutor, Stephen Casella, who, by the way, had been in charge at the Maine Department of Justice of asset forfeiture. He literally wrote the book on asset forfeiture that all prosecutors use. And we explained that, look, the Sowers never heard of structuring. They had no intent to violate any law. And This was all a misunderstanding, and could you please return the funds? He needs the money for bills and farming. They agreed that there's no underlying criminal activity, but they said, no, you're structuring. He offered to return half of the $60,000, or about $30,000, but we started to negotiate for more when the Baltimore City paper called Mr. Sowers about this grand jury subpoena and said, hey, you know, what's going on here? You're an icon in this area. What have you done? Well, he explained the story that this what happened. This was innocent on his part. But the day after the story appeared, Mr. Casella stopped all negotiations, filed a lawsuit in federal court, threatening to seize more than $200,000 of what past deposits that had been made. Now the Sowers needed the funds to farm. They couldn't fight the case. It would take months, years. So they were forced to settle for this $30,000. Now, interestingly enough, the settlement agreement had a provision in it where it said that the Sowers admitted that the government had just cause to seize the funds. We objected to that, saying, look, we're not going to admit anything here. This is completely innocent. And Stephen Casella said, oh, that's a standard clause we have in these settlement agreements. And they were citing another case he had going after a farmer on the Eastern Shore that was also an innocent victim of this trap. I had got a copy of that agreement, and there was no such clause in there that they were trying to put in the one for Sowers. So we emailed back Casella and said, well, why are you treating us differently than the Taylors? These are not the same. And he said, quote, well, Mr. Taylor did not give an interview to the press, end quote. So you can see here he was also being punished for exercising his First Amendment rights. Well, go back 2 weeks ago at the hearing where Mr. Sowers testified, the panel chaired by Congressman Peter Roskam and both the Democrats and Republicans were simply outraged at the way Mr. Sowers was being treated. Mr. Taylor, the other farmer on the Eastern Shore, was also a witness, as well as Rob here on the line. The one congressman put up a slide at the hearing room that had a dictionary definition of extortion, and said that this one of the definitions that this was a shakedown, and indeed that's what they were subject to, this extortion. In the hot seat after the hearing was the commissioner of the IRS there, and also the deputy AG on crim from the Justice Department, and they were getting all kinds of critical questions about the way they were treating Mr. Sowers and so forth, and they claim that they're trying to change their policy, that they're trying to no longer go after innocent people like him. Now, thanks, well, with the help of the Institute for Justice and Rob here on the line, last summer we filed a petition for remission to give the money back to the Sowers on the grounds that, look, they did nothing wrong. You wouldn't go after them today under your current policy, because your current policy now says only go after people who have an underlying crime of trying to hide these funds, whether it's drug dealing, terrorist activity, or tax evasion. And therefore, it's only just you give it back to the Sowers and the other victims. When pressed what's taking the government so long to do it, the IRS was pointing the finger at the Justice Department. The Justice Department was saying, well, this takes time to look this over, et cetera. They were basically trying to deflect being accountable here. And Congressman Charlie Rangel was really upset about that and asked the chairman, maybe we should have another hearing with these guys who keep stalling on this and basically hold them accountable. They apologized, the members of Congress, on behalf of the American people, the way my client was being treated, called them American heroes, and this is a clear example of overreaching by the federal government. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rob to talk a little bit more about his case and the larger issue of this asset forfeiture.
Well, thanks, Paul. And yeah, I mean, I think I just want to start by saying this, you know, Randy's case is both shocking, but also part of a much broader pattern that we've seen in a number of these cases involving the structuring laws. You know, at IJ, we've represented now a number of property owners who had their entire bank account seized under the structuring laws simply because they were making deposits under $10,000. And in each of those cases, the property owners had perfectly innocent reasons for limiting the size of their deposits. We represented Terry Deco, a grocery store owner in Michigan, who had an insurance policy that only covered cash in the store up to $10,000. We represented Carol Hinders, a restaurant owner in Iowa, who was told by a bank teller, much like Randy, that deposits over $10,000 generated paperwork, and it was simply a hassle for the bank. And then we represented the Hirsch brothers on Long Island, who run a distribution business, who were told that they had several banks actually close their bank accounts because the volume of over $10,000 cash deposits was creating a headache for the bank. And they were told by their accountant, well, if you just keep your deposits under $10,000, you won't have your banks closing your accounts. I like to think of this area with the structuring laws as actually like a perfect storm of over-criminalization, where you have both incredibly overbroad statutes, sort of substantive statutes, the structuring laws, that are then married with incredibly punitive procedures under the civil forfeiture laws that allow the government to take property based only on a showing of probable cause, which in the structuring area just means a pattern of over $10,000 deposits, under $10,000 deposits. And then once that money is seized, to hold it for months or years, it could take a minimum of 150 days before you even have a complaint filed in federal court where the government's trying to make that forfeiture permanent. And so you're waiting for months or years even to have a chance to see a judge. Much less to actually present your case and get that money back. And in the meantime, what the government is doing is it's pressuring property owners to agree to settlements. So in each of the cases that I've mentioned, as well as the Sowers case, the common thread is that the government is coming to these property owners and it's saying, well, why don't we pick a number somewhere in the middle between zero and the amount that we forfeited, and then we'll just call it a day. We'll come up with a deal where you'll agree to forfeit some percentage, usually 50%, and then we'll get to keep some percentage, usually 50%. And I think as Paul, you know, explained very clearly in Randy's case, that's an offer that for many people is simply impossible to refuse. So anyway, that's the sort of background on this. In October of 2014, issue really came to light with a front-page article in the New York Times that featured Carol Hinders and Jeff Hirsch, both IJ clients. And in kind of a remarkable turn of events, when the IRS was called for comment by the New York Times, they decided, well, gosh, maybe we really shouldn't be doing this. So they actually announced in the pages of the New York Times a policy change where they said they were no longer going to be taking money under the structuring laws unless they had a reason to believe that the structuring was being done in order to actually conceal some sort of underlying criminal activity. Because after all, that's really what the government supposedly is concerned about with these structuring laws, is people who are evading bank reports in order to conceal some sort of actual crime. So that policy change occurs in 2014. But it has really, I think, two big holes in it. One is that it's not retroactive to cases that were pending at the time the policy change went into effect. And these are cases where the money was seized before the policy change was announced. But the government is still going forward with attempts to take that money and to make these seizures into permanent forfeitures. And so not long after the policy change was announced, we had another case on behalf of a North Carolina convenience store owner named Lyndon McClellan, where the government was trying to make permanent the forfeiture of $107,000 that was seized from his bank. And just as a side, you know, the email that that Paul described coming from Casella is not unique. It's part of a pattern of these types of emails. In that case, Lyndon's case was actually discussed by members of Congress at a hearing in February of 2015. And after the case was discussed, the AUSA on the case sent an email to Lyndon's attorney, and he said to the attorney that he was upset that information about the case had been provided to members of Congress. And he said, publicity about the case doesn't help. It only ratchets up feelings in the agency. And then he concluded with a 50% settlement offer. And so, of course, we did what is the only natural thing to do. We provided a copy of that email to the New York Times. The case received an enormous amount of press attention, and the government quickly backed down and agreed to give Lyndon his money back. And you would have thought maybe that would be a lesson for the government, that they would stop going forward with all these cases. But it turns out it wasn't. Recently, we found yet another case where the government is continuing to go after this property owner. This case was a bakery in Connecticut. It was a group of a family in Connecticut, the Vacatura family. It's a third-generation family business. And in their case, the government seized $68,000, their entire bank account, again, just because they were depositing money in the bank in amounts under $10,000. And in that case, the government actually threatened to go after them criminally, because structuring is, in fact, a felony offense, that you can be sentenced up to 5 years for structuring. And what the government said was, after the Vacaturas had refused to agree to the forfeiture of their funds, they said, the government said, well, we want you to agree to a plea agreement where you would not only forfeit the initial $68,000 that we seized, but also agree to forfeit an additional $160,000 in personal assets, and also go to jail for up to 4 years. And when the Vacaturas refused that plea agreement, you might have thought the government would then prosecute them for structuring. But instead, what the government did was say, well, now we're going to launch against you and your business a criminal tax investigation, and we're going to subpoena 8 years' worth of every record for your business. So the Vacaturas received a grand jury subpoena demanding 8 years' worth of records for their business. Really, quite literally, every record that has been produced over the last 8 years. And the Vacaturas, despite the amount of pressure that you could imagine that would impose on any small business, continued to stand firm and said, no, we're not going to do that. And so they came to the Institute for Justice, and we actually filed on their behalf a motion demanding the return of the initial $68,000, and we were prepared to litigate the issue of the grand jury subpoena as well. But lo and behold, as soon as we fought back against the government melted away. Within hours of our filing, our motion for the return of property, the government contacted us and said, oh, well, we'll give you that money back, but we're still going to go forward with our grand jury subpoena. Then fast forward another week after the hearing that Paul was describing, and then the government says, oh, well, forget it. We're not going to do the grand jury subpoena either. And what you see is this kind of amazing situation that we're in, where this policy change that I mentioned from back in October 2014, supposedly, according to the government, doesn't apply to currently pending cases. But apparently it does apply once IJ finds those cases and publicizes them in the news. So the government is perfectly happy to do this in the shadows. But as soon as something is brought into the light of public attention, well, then they're not going to do it anymore. And then the second real hole in this policy change is that it doesn't apply to past cases where the forfeiture occurred and became final after the policy change. And Randy's case falls into that category. And then another case that came to IJ's attention involved another North Carolina convenience store owner named Ken Curran, and his case fell into that same situation as well. And we don't know exactly how many such cases there are, but we do know through a Freedom of Information Act request that we submitted that there are over 600 cases between 2007 and 2013 where the IRS seized money under the structuring laws and then forfeited it and did not report in its own records any suspicion of any criminal wrongdoing apart from the mere act of under $10,000 deposits. And in those about 600 cases, the IRS forfeited about $43 million. So we think that some substantial subset of that are cases like the ones we're discussing here, where people didn't do anything wrong apart from depositing their money in the bank. So what we hit upon as a strategy was, as Paul was mentioning, filing petitions for remission or mitigation. And we filed one on behalf of Randy, and then we filed a second on behalf of Ken Caron, the North Carolina convenience store owner. And lo and behold, the IRS actually granted Ken's petition back in February. The IRS responded with basically a one-paragraph fax that came to us here at IJ's offices, and it said that, without any real reasoning, it said that the petition has been granted, and it's been granted in full. And so in Ken's case, the government had seized $150,000, and they agreed to return 100% of it, which is remarkable because it means that the government is acknowledging that they do have the power and indeed that they have the obligation to reopen these old cases and to give money back to people where the money was taken under circumstances where it wouldn't be seized today under current policies. And yet despite that, we're still waiting for any decision on Randy's petition. And that seems to be owed to an accident of procedure, that because of the procedural details of the cases and the time at which the forfeiture occurred relevant to whether the government had actually filed or not filed a forfeiture complaint, the petition in Ken's case went to the IRS and was granted by the IRS, but the petition in Randy's case goes to the Department of Justice and will be decided by the Department of Justice. And so the IRS seems to be contrite and actually trying to make this right by giving people money back. But what remains to be seen is whether the Department of Justice is going to do the same. Now, just to wrap this up, I would just sort of say again that as Paul described, the House Ways and Means Oversight Subcommittee has been extraordinarily supportive in our efforts to get people their money back. They've been on the IRS and the Department of Justice like a very angry dog. And, it's been very effective in raising the profile of this issue and putting an incredible amount of pressure onto these agencies. And, what we intend to do is, in Randy's case, is just to keep that avenue of pressure open and to keep, hopefully, to have the committee to continue to pressure the the Department of Justice, but at the same time also to continue to raise the profile of the issue in the media and with the public, and hopefully the Department of Justice will see the light and decide to do the right thing as well.
Great. Thanks very much, Rob. Paul, I'm wondering if you can hit on some of the other Overcrim cases out there, like the U.S. v. Clay and the Bank of America cases?
Yeah, sure, Tim. Yeah, besides, the government going after small farmers and small businesses and the Yates case where they went after the fishermen under Sarbanes-Oxley, there is a lot of abusive enforcement and overcrim against big businesses and corporate executives that deserve attention as well. Real quick, about a week or two ago, the Second Circuit came out with a big decision in favor of Bank of America and Countrywide. They reversed a $1.2 billion, that's billion with a B, penalty against Countrywide and $1 million penalty imposed on their COO for allegedly violating the what's called the Federal Institutions Reform, Recovery, and Enforcement Act, FIREA, of 1989, for alleged mail-in wire fraud and selling the bad mortgages to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae during the meltdown crisis, housing crisis in 2007-2008. This started as a QUITAM whistleblower case, et cetera, and it provides, the statute provides for penalties for violating the mail and wire fraud statutes. Now, the government argued that Country Rights sold loans knowing that they were not investment quality grade and intended to defraud the government. Well, the issue before the Second Circuit that they ruled on is whether a breach of a contractual promise with the government, even an intentional breach, without proof of fraudulent intent at the time of contracting, and that's important, it's at the time that the court looks at of the contract execution, whether that could sustain a claim of fraud under the law. And the Second Circuit held that, and I'm reading a quote, the proper time for identifying fraudulent intent is contemporaneous with the making of the promise, not when the victim relies on the promise or is injured by it. Only if a contractual promise is made with no intent ever to perform can the promise itself constitute a fraudulent misrepresentation, end quote. And so what the court did was reverse that huge penalty and held that the government did not prove mens rea or intent, that Country Right intended at the time they were making the contract, they intended to dump lower quality mortgages on Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. And the court concluded, quote, because we construe the federal mail and wire fraud statutes to require proof of contemporaneous fraudulent intent consistent with the common law, the government felt its burden. So that case was basically a quasi-criminal case. The government was trying to, because there was this problem with the mortgage crisis, that they are trying to claim that these defendants were guilty of fraud, mail and wire fraud, instead of going under a simple contract action. And this case portends well in the next case I want to discuss, U.S. versus Clay, which is pending in the 11th Circuit, and one which the Federal Society also has done a telephone call on it, as well as the courthouse steps call when it was argued last October. In that case, you had 200 FBI agents raid the offices of WellCare, a Florida Medicaid provider, and snatched up all their computers, charged the company with Medicaid fraud on the basis of an accounting dispute under the contract that they had with Florida on allowable expenses. Real quick, the Florida law, Medicaid law, says that the recipient has to spend 80% of the funds they get on medical services, Medicaid services, and they can keep 20% for overhead. If they spend less than 80%, that has to be remitted back to the Florida Medicaid office. Well, over the years, they did that. They remitted money less than 80% that they spent. But then all of a sudden you had the 200 FBI agents and an indictment of the company claiming that the way the company was interpreting the 80-20 law that included expenses they made to the subsidiary was not the way the government thought it should be interpreted. Well, there were no clarifying regulations whatsoever on how to interpret this vague statute. The company had their general counsel sign off on this accounting procedure. They also had the former head of the Florida Medicaid department, who is now working for them after he left that office, say, yes, that's perfectly fine. Other companies allow accounting to the subsidiaries. But nevertheless, the company quickly agreed to a deferred prosecution agreement, telling the government, okay, we'll cry uncle, quickly, let's sign. And they threw their CEO, the COO, the CFO, and the general counsel were all indicted. They were thrown under the bus for alleged Medicaid fraud. Then the company agreed to revise their earnings to the SEC to reflect the alleged over-profit that they made for this alleged fraud. Now, the trial took like 3 months with various accounting experts. The jury, after 1 month deliberation, was deadlocked. The court read an Allen charge. They came back after a 10-day vacation to return a verdict. The verdict was mixed. There were some acquittals, some hung charges, and a couple of guilty counts, one on the way the accounting was done for 2006 although the same accounting procedure was done for 2005, and they were acquitted on that. So you could see it was a confusing verdict. The government wanted to throw the CEO, who's a Harvard MBA entrepreneur, to go to prison for 20 years for this accounting dispute, which, by the way, during the trial, even the government's accounting experts testified that the way that the company did the accounting was not an unreasonable interpretation of the law. In fact, there were like four or five methods of accounting that were deemed to be reasonable. On appeal, there's two main issues. One is, and this is an important one for regulatory enforcement, and that is whether under this case called Whiteside versus United States in the 11th Circuit, whether if you have an objectively reasonable interpretation of the statute or regulation, then there simply is no crime. There's no actus reus. Therefore, the argument is there's no crime here because this was a reasonable interpretation of the law. The judge gave that to the jury to decide. That's a question of law that the district judge should have decided. So this is something we're asking the 11th Circuit to decide that issue of law. And then the second issue is the mens rea issue, that even if there were crime, the CEO certainly had no mens rea to violate the law. He wasn't the one that submitted the financial data to the government. He had sought advice from the general counsel on the proper accounting. The case was, like I said, on appeal in the 11th Circuit. It was argued October 2nd, so it's 8 months in counting since it's been there. Seth Waxman, the former solicitor general, argued the case on behalf of the CEO. It was a rare two-hour oral argument. You don't really get that in the Court of Appeals argument. It's important to note that the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, NACDL, filed an amicus brief of the case along with the Reason Foundation, several law professors from George Washington GMU, and a healthcare expert at AEI. And I was at the oral argument, and if you sat there and just walked in, you would think this was purely an accounting dispute, a civil appeal on how do we interpret this contract and provision XYZ and this thick contract and so forth, and not a major felony case. Here we have an example of the government criminalizing contract and regulatory disputes, which we argue and public policy groups like Federal Society and others should be handled administratively or civilly. In fact, in this very case, the government went after a competitor who was using the same accounting procedure, filed only a civil contract action against the company, settled for $0 as long as the company agreed in the future to do the accounting the way the government wanted to do it. So the argument, like I said, went very well, we thought. Sharp questioning by one of the circuit judges and grilled the prosecutor also on an issue dealing with prejudicial evidence where the government submitted the SEC restatement of earnings to the jury to say, hey, look, there must be fraud going on, ladies and gentlemen, jury. Here's this restatement of earnings they did with the SEC, which, by the way, they were required to do so under this deferred prosecution agreement. And so there's under the rules of evidence, the question is whether that should come in, whether its prejudicial value outweighs its probative value. And the judge said at the argument, this is, quote, big time prejudicial. So this case has raised important issues for the entire regulatory community and the legal policy groups like Federal Society, Washington Legal Foundation, Cato Heritage, and others have written about this case, and it's one that I'm sure we'll be revisiting once the decision comes down, hopefully with good news. So that's it.
All right, great. Thanks for that, Paul. I think this is probably a good time to open up the floor to audience questions. So in a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt that says the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. While we wait for some questions to queue up, I have a couple that I'd like to lead off with. The first one's for Rob. I'm wondering what has been the Justice Department and the IRS's response to the question of the necessity of asset forfeiture. Doesn't it have a legitimate role in crime enforcement to help curb money laundering and the like?
Yeah, you know, and they certainly make that claim. And, you know, nobody is saying that criminals, actual criminals, should be allowed to get off scot-free. But I think what the problem that we're seeing is that the way the civil forfeiture laws work allows the government to take property from people who may not be criminals, as in all the cases that we've been talking about here today and Randy's case, and then to force those people to fight to get their property back. And it's completely backwards. The way that the world ought to work is that the government has to prove that you're guilty before they can punish you. But the way that it works under civil forfeiture is that they punish you, and then you have an opportunity to prove that you're innocent. And no rational, fair criminal justice system can be operated that way.
And second question is for you, Paul. Don't we need strong enforcement of laws against fraud against the government?
Well, yeah, we certainly do. For example, in Medicaid fraud cases, the typical cases where the company has phantom patients, they're doing false billing, they're jacking up the prices of their services, et cetera. That's the kind of fraud that definitely needs to be rooted out and criminally prosecuted. When you have a reasonable differences of how you interpret the statute in question, there are more reasonable administrative and civil remedies to handle these kinds of cases rather than the heavy hand of criminal law. So, yes, we need strong enforcement of the fraud laws against the government, where contractors defraud the government. But in cases like the Clay case, that certainly did not belong on the criminal docket. And even in the Second Circuit case, which was kind of quasi-criminal, the Second Circuit gave a sharp rebuke to the government, even in that context. And we see more and more the courts are cracking down on the government overreach in the corporate crime area with insider trading, where the government prosecutors are stretching the definition of what is insider trading, what does the criminal law mean, et cetera. So we're saying, look, let Congress make the laws clear and let you agencies, you know, lay out the roadmap of the rules of the road so the regulated community can understand them and make sure they're not running afoul of those laws, but to basically play a game of this gotcha where there's this arbitrary discretion that they use and getting a sympathetic jury to go after those big bad executives who have stock options and are wealthy, we've got to put them behind bars. That's just simply unfair, unjust, and not proper procedure. And then, by the way, in the Clay case, I said the government wanted the CEO to go to prison for 20 years. The district judge would heard none of that. I said, look, you know, there was no real harm done here, that the government was overreaching, but the jury verdict came back guilty. He put out a sentence of 3 years in prison under the guidelines, but as you can imagine, even 3 years or even one day in jail for a non-crime is too much.
Thanks for that answer, Paul. We got a few audience members on the line. Remember to request the floor, enter star, and then the pound key on your phone. With that, we're going to go to the first audience caller.
Oh, hi. Yeah, a question whether you're seeing any of the results of this spillover into just straight banking relationships. You You mentioned, one of you mentioned the fact that banks have been closing accounts because of too many over $10,000 deposits. We had a situation where a small business owner was actually depositing checks, had received a big payment, and was depositing checks, not cash, but checks, less than $10,000, but did a series of them for budgeting purposes. Everything was reported. There was zero intent whatsoever. The bank closed the business owner's account, and then I guess, you know, I wasn't familiar, we weren't familiar with the structuring stuff. They completely refused to tell the person why the bank account was closed, although it was kind of gleaned. It was because of these series of checks, not cash transfers. And now it doesn't seem to be any remedy whatsoever to, in case there's some sort of flag, to alert the IRS or Treasury or whoever, hey, we'll be happy to say we do, just don't do anything to us. And then the poor guy is scared. And it just seems like the banks should be able to, the law should be, allow the banks to just say, give a reason why it's done. And there's zero criminal intent whatsoever. I mean, it's all completely above board. And the laughable part, it's because of cash. It's because of checks, not cash. And, you know, these banks are probably scared that they're going to suffer the wrath of the IRS too.
So, yeah, this is Rob Johnson. So, you know, one of the amazing things about this whole bank reporting system is that it's actually illegal, a felony, for a bank to tell a customer that they have filed a report with the IRS specifically. So the way the reporting works, you've got two types of reports. One, currency transaction reports, which are generated by over $10,000 deposits, but then you have suspicious activity reports that are generated whenever you have what looks like a pattern of suspicious activity. And you know, in the years following 9/11, and particularly picking up around 2007, there's been a big push to basically require banks to implement computerized automatic systems to basically spy on their customers and to generate these suspicious activity reports automatically without any human intervention when you have a customer who's, you know, for instance, generating a series of under $10,000 cash transactions, or yeah, as you suggest, it can even be checks or other you know, other instruments. Although I would note that there's nothing illegal about cash, so the fact that the government is so focused on cash, you know, is problematic in its own respect. It's perfectly legal to have a cash business, and lots of businesses, for perfectly legitimate reasons, are in fact primarily cash businesses. But in any event, the sort of point I wanted to start with is just that one of the amazing things here is that it actually is illegal for a bank to tell a customer that they have filed one of these suspicious activity reports with the IRS, which really it takes the bank customer relationship and it does something really odd to it, where it turns the bank into a sort of agent of the government who's charged with spying on their customers and can't even tell their customers that they're doing it or why.
Yeah, exactly. That's when we mention that back to the client, then you kind of know what happened. I mean, simply when they say, well, we're not allowed to tell you,
right,
you know what happened. And so then the client is sitting there now just has to worry, well, there's no remedy for that.
Right.
I mean, there's the who do they go to? Can they go to the Treasury? Can they go to IRS and say, hey, we have reason to believe the report was filed on us, and here's the straight scoop, so just stop if you're investigating, stop it, you know?
Yeah, and that's the other sort of amazing thing. This is Rob again. In all of these cases, the seizures are happening without anybody asking the customer why they are,
right,
you know, depositing money the way they're depositing it.
Yeah, this is Paul Kamen coming in. Yeah, one other aspect about that is that the Office of Comptroller Currency has regulations that says if you are a publicly traded company on any stock exchange, you are automatically exempt from the structuring laws in terms of having forms filled out for under $10,000, over $10,000. And then there's a provision that says if you're not a listed company, if you're a small business like Randy Sowers, a farmer, or a restaurant or dry cleaners, whatever, doing in cash, that they have what's supposed to happen with the bank is that if, after you do 2 months of your deposits, then you're further exempt from any of these currency transaction reports being filled out or suspicious activity reports. And the point is that information is not being given to the depositor, so they know this is what the policy is. When you go into bank and open up a bank account, there's all kinds of things there in their brochure, like here's how you can get a loan, here's our mortgage products, et cetera. There's nothing that says, oh, by the way, here's the Bank Secrecy Act. Here's what they may not be able to tell you that they filed a report on you, but they can certainly tell you here's what the law is generally, and here's how you can comply with the law by coming to us and saying you're a legitimate business. So this is one thing I raised with the commissioner of the IRS at the hearing a couple weeks ago, that they should get the comptroller of the currency getting these banks on board. And even, in fact, the Department of Justice and the Office of Financial Central Crime Enforcement Network also said that that regulation should be used to the fullest so that we don't have these kind of problems. But again, everything is kind of kept mum on this whole thing.
Thank you.
All right, another caller on the line. Just a reminder, if you'd like to join the queue, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone. Next caller, you have the floor.
Hi, how are you? This is Francis Menton of the Manhattan Contrarian website, and I've written about these issues quite a bit. A couple of things. One, I guess it was Rob who pointed out some of the problems with the new IRS policy. Isn't the biggest problem that they completely reserve the right to change back to the old way as soon as the spotlight isn't on them anymore? And what's going to stop them from doing that? Which leads really to the next question, which was thanks a lot for Congress to put on some pressure here. But isn't the people who are responsible for this situation really the Congress, who have passed a structuring law which does not require any underlying crime? And as I understand it, the intent requirement of the structuring law is with intent to evade the filing of the forms. So actually the crime occurs when the bank says, gee, can you help me avoid filing the forms by making your deposit $9,000? Well, that is about as stupid a law as there could be. Thanks to Congress for putting pressure on the IRS, but what about changing the damn law? Anybody suggesting that?
So, yeah, this is Rob again. You know, it's a great point, and it is, you know, important that we get that policy change enacted as a statute, not just because the agency could change the policy at any time, as you suggested, but also because you know, the way it stands today, if you're somebody who is targeted in violation of the policy doesn't give you any protection in court. I mean, I suppose you could try to make an argument that it does, but that would be a uphill fight. So absolutely, you know, we've been working with Congress on that, and in the House they've introduced what's called the Due Process Act, which is an act that's designed to reform the civil forfeiture laws in a variety of ways. And one of the things that that act includes is a requirement that before the IRS seizes money under the structuring laws, they have to allege that there's some kind of underlying criminal activity. So it basically tries to codify the policy change. Now, we've pointed out to members of Congress that the far simpler and better thing to do would be to change the definition of structuring itself, because what they've tried to do is rather than change the definition of the crime, which I understand apparently the Department of Justice is very opposed to for reasons that are not clear to me, but rather than change the definition of the crime, they want to build it into the civil forfeiture provision that applies to the crime. Which would mean that they couldn't go after you with civil forfeiture, but they could still charge you with the felony charge of structuring. So, you know, I guess the sort of short answer there is that it is very important that we get this enacted in a statute. It's not enough that it's just a policy. And, you know, progress is being made on that front, but at the same time, more needs to happen.
All right. Thanks very much. We're going to go to another caller. I believe we have Jack Park on the line. Jack, are you with us?
Yeah. Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you. You have the floor.
Yeah, I guess I got two questions. First, on the reform, wouldn't it make sense just to bump the threshold for structuring from 10,000 to a higher figure? And second, you know, you've gotten some pushback after going to the press from U.S. attorneys and DOJ personnel. Have you gone to the DOJ IG about that? Because that sounds to me like it's improper.
Sure. Yeah, two good questions. So, again, this is Rob. On the first, you know, it's another good point. The $10,000 threshold was enacted in the 1970s, and it's never been adjusted for inflation. So, you know, when we're talking about $10,000 in 1970 currency, that's about $60,000 in today's currency. So just adjusting that $10,000 threshold for inflation would make a huge difference. I mean, the volume of currency transaction reports, the reports that are generated by over $10,000 transactions has ballooned from about 1,000 per year in the 1970s to over 1 million per year today. So absolutely, that threshold should be adjusted. Not that that would be a complete fix, but that would help. In terms of going to the IG, you know, that is something that has come out of these hearings, that the Department of Justice has referred both the email, is looking into both the email from Steve Casella, or Steph Casella, rather, and then also the email in the Lyndon McClellan case that I mentioned. They're looking into that as well.
Yeah, this is Paul. Jack, thanks for joining the call, and appreciate your commenting on the prior telephone call on the Clay case on the courthouse steps. But to address your question here, it came up that these emails were given to the Office of Professional Responsibility, but the Department of Justice witness was very circumspect about talking about that at the open hearing. He was asked at least three or four times, don't you think that it's improper for a prosecutor to impose retribution on a citizen for going to the press complaining about how they're being treated by the government? And he kept giving, dancing around that, saying, well, yeah, they should be doing that, et cetera. And then when he was asked the obvious question, well, then do you agree what would happen here was wrong? Well, Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that, et cetera, et cetera. So he was blowing hot and cold, and it was clear that the committee, both Democrats and Republicans, were upset with that kind of answer, as well as upset about why it's taking 6-7 months to give Randy's money back. The remark by the DOJ guy saying, well, justice has to be carefully done here or something along those lines. And we all know the more popular adage that justice delayed is justice denied. And that's clearly what's going on here. But you're right. There should be these ethics investigations of the prosecutors trying to impose retribution for citizens exercising their First Amendment rights.
All right, thanks for the question, Jack. That leaves our lines wide open once again. If you have a question, go ahead and hit star and then the pound key on your telephone.
In the meantime, this is Paul again. I would like to just comment with respect to what Rob was saying earlier on that there's other cases out there. They've identified some 600 cases where this may be going on of seizing funds where there's no underlying criminal action. And as Rob said, they did a Freedom of Information request to the IRS, and Rob could speak probably better to this, of course. But they told them, okay, we'll give you this background information, but we want $250,000 from this nonprofit public interest group to turn over the information. At that point, the committee chair and the minority ranking member just went ballistic, said this is outrageous that they would charge you that. And they said, look, give us your request. We'll submit the request to the IRS. And the chairman looked at the DOJ, and the commissioner said, and you're not going to charge us for search fees and copy fees. So you can see how the IRS and DOJ still playing fast and loose and being obstructive about trying to do the right thing here.
Yeah, this is Rob again. You know, it's one of the sort of amazing things here is that what we're seeking through that request is just access to what's called the IRS AFTRAC database, which is a database that has information on all the seizures and forfeitures by the Internal Revenue Service. And we requested a similar database from the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice turned their database over to us at no charge, and then maybe came to regret it because the database was then turned over to the Washington Post and became the basis for a Washington Post series of about six articles all about civil forfeiture. So now the IRS is, you know, faced with a request for their database, and they're saying, well, we're not going to give it to you unless you pay $750,000 to us, which, you know, is absolutely absurd.
All right, we're just about up against the top of the hour here, so I will kick it back to our experts for some final thoughts and to wrap up. Rob, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, so, you know, one sort of aspect of this that hasn't been discussed yet, which I think bears mentioning, is just that, you know, when the IRS is taking money from people under the structuring laws or in general using any sort of civil forfeiture or even criminal forfeiture, the IRS gets to keep the money that it seizes. And so this is very different from like a normal sort of tax audit situation where the IRS is taking money that then goes into the general treasury and can be used to fund the sort of general operations of the government. Here we're actually dealing with a situation where the IRS is taking money from people, and then the IRS gets to keep it and can use it to fund its own budget. And we're talking about enormous amounts of money that have been seized. Under the structuring laws alone, we're talking about $242 million about a period of 7 years. So it's a huge incentive for the government to take money from people who haven't done anything wrong. And I think that profit incentive really underlies a lot of what we're talking about here. And, you know, I mentioned briefly the Due Process Act, which has a lot of great reforms to the civil forfeiture laws, but one of the important things that it doesn't do is it doesn't do anything to address that profit incentive. So we're hoping that as the Due Process Act moves through the House and then eventually the Senate, that something will be added into the act to address that concern with the profit incentive that's created by the civil forfeiture laws. The other thing I just want to mention is that we have a debate coming up. It's going to be sponsored by the Young Lawyers chapter of the Federalist Society. It's going to be a debate between an attorney here at IJ, Darpana Seth, and then Stefan Casella on the other side. Stefan will be defending the practice of civil forfeiture. And, you know, for those of you who may not have caught it, that Stefan is the U.S. attorney, assistant United States attorney, who handled the Randy Sowers case and who sent the email that Paul mentioned about retaliation for protected First Amendment activity. So it should be a fascinating debate. It's going to be on the 23rd, and I think more concrete details will follow, but just wanted to, you know, let people know about that.
Anything from you, Paul?
Thanks. Rob, I'll certainly want to be there at that debate with Steph and Casella and have some sharp questions to ask him in the Q&A. I'd just like to conclude by, first of all, thanking the Federalist Society for having this teleforum. And while we may be seeing some easing up on this asset forfeiture practice because of the change in policy, so to speak, with the however, with the new Department of Justice Yates memo requiring companies to turn their execs in order to get leniency, we can expect more prosecutorial abuses with respect to bigger companies. And so what we need are federal prosecutors to follow their own guidelines. It's in their U.S. Attorney's Manual, which clearly says before you consider using the criminal law for prosecution, either companies or individuals, you should first consider using administrative or civil remedies rather than criminal remedies, and defer to the states if there's overlapping jurisdiction for those kinds of cases. So our only hope is for the courts at this point to start reining in the government abuses and for Congress to enact criminal law reform measures such as requiring mens rea as a default intent standard on some of these regulatory offenses. Looking forward to a victory in the Clay case. Thanks.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to once again thank Paul Kaminar and Rob Johnson for joining us today. Thanks also to our audience and for everyone who chimed in with their questions. Look for the podcast of this recording if you missed something up on our website, and keep checking back for the next teleforms that will be they'll be scheduled shortly. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.